Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Zero Emissions Corsa E with a range of up to 337 kilometres, it's simply electric.
But first this morning, the increase in hospitalisations from COVID-19 has been described as a very concerning trend by the chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid. In a tweet last night, he said there were 90 people being treated for the virus in hospital, which includes 19 in ICU. Now, this compares to just 23 hospitalisations with 8 in ICU. That's 4 weeks ago. And to take a closer look at this, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, consultant in intensive care medicine at the Mater Hospital and president of the Intensive Care Society in Ireland. Dr. O'Loughlin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire.
So do you agree then with the HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid that what we're looking at here is a very concerning trend?
Yeah, I can see that. I can see why there's concern being expressed by Paul Reid and his colleagues. The numbers don't lie. They are increasing. For example, here in the Mater, yesterday we would have had 16 patients with COVID positive in the hospital, and this morning 21. And as you mentioned there, the increase in cases in ICU is well documented as well. I'm counting 16 on the most updated bed information system data that we have nationally. Interestingly, 7 of those are outside of Dublin, so it does speak to a national problem rather than just a Dublin problem. But the concern is real, and I suppose the foundation for that concern is the concern is what happens if this becomes a surge similar to the phase one that we saw last March and April.
Yeah, because it's clear that the rate is not where we were back then at the start of all of this. But where is the tipping point?
That's a very good question, and we're having daily meetings here in our hospital, and I'm sure other hospitals are doing the same, looking for that. Where's the trigger for saying this is becoming a meaningful surge and we have to take other actions? It's not clear. I think it's done on a day-to-day basis. The worry is, as Mr. Reid pointed out, that when we see figures like 300 or 400 in the community on any given day, that a percentage of those will require hospitalisation, and a percentage of that, again, will require intensive care beds. And until we see it kind of a trend of increased rate of admissions, I think it's fair to say yes, that the numbers are low and the rate of rise is not something that we saw, let's say, in March, where there was 20 being admitted per day to the intensive care. At the moment, as you said, there's probably 10 to 15 extra cases from the start of September till now. So it's something we're reviewing very, very closely.
And the people who do need to be hospitalised, who do need to be treated in intensive care, Dr. O'Loughlin, are they as sick? Are they presenting with the same sorts of complaints and conditions as they were in March?
Yes, as we know, it's predominantly a respiratory disease. So most patients are presenting with respiratory failure. Some of this is managed on the ward and gets better, and some doesn't respond to ward level care and needs to come to intensive care. However, it's not all just respiratory. Some patients are having neurological impact. Some patients have cardiological impact on their heart. So it's wider than just the respiratory impact, but certainly that is definitely the main organ to be influenced by this virus.
And then in terms of how hospitals are dealing with this time round, last time it was quite different, wasn't it? Because almost everything else was shut down to deal with this. That can't happen now again.
Well, we're trying our best not to make that happen. I mean, we have an obligation to care for all patients, not just COVID-positive patients. There are patients undergoing active chemotherapy, patients with critical cardiovascular disease that need and deserve healthcare as well. So we're doing our best to run parallel systems and keep things going as best possible. But you're right in saying that the method we employed the last time to deal with this was to close down all services and redeploy as many staff as we could to the intensive care unit, at the same time keeping emergency services going. And that was based on what we were seeing in London, in Lombardy, in Madrid, etc. And we were looking to see how best we could try and deal with a situation should that arise. As we know, the impact of lockdown first time around was very positive, and the numbers didn't come to surge to that level. So we managed to deal with patients very successfully. Indeed, we had a very good outcome in terms of intensive care patients, with a mortality of only 20%, which is very favourable compared to international data. So this time around, we are certainly more, I suppose, aware of our obligations to other patients and the need to keep services going, which creates a whole new level of problems, because trying to run both services in parallel is very difficult.
And you also have the problem of the season, and we're heading into winter, and that means flu is on the way. And I see reports in the paper again today, a letter being sent to GPs and pharmacies around the country confirming delays to the delivery of the flu vaccine. Now, does that concern you?
Yes, I suppose it does. Flu is very interesting, and it's difficult to predict how that's going to play out. Normally, we kind of look at two different things. We take a lead sometimes from the data we see from the preceding flu season in the southern hemisphere, mostly Australia. And if we look at their data, so far, interestingly enough, they're showing a very mild flu season. Now, that doesn't always translate to the same situation up here in the northern hemisphere, but it does often follow on as that. So they're kind of explaining that as a function of the same measure that you'd use to mitigate transmission of coronavirus often work for, or should work for, influenza virus as well. So social distancing, cough etiquette, hand washing, etc., should have the same impact on reducing transmission of influenza virus. And that's one of the reasons they're explaining that in the southern hemisphere. Plus the fact we have in our armamentarium a vaccine for flu influenza. So both of those things need to work hand in hand, the vaccine and the social distancing. And I believe if we do that, we hopefully, again, none of this is accurate science, but hopefully we'll see an ability to control flu so there won't be such a negative impact on the system as it can be.
And then we have the investment coming, the winter plan, which will be announced in detail, we expect later this week. That's 600 million. That's a huge increase on what it was in previous years. Are you hopeful that that might help with problems you're likely to face?
I'm hopeful that it will. There are some challenges within that. We're running just slightly above our baseline intensive care capacity at the moment. We normally operate on the 270 number of beds, adult public beds nationally. We're around 280, 282 this morning. So we haven't gone a very long way in increasing the baseline intensive care capacity. And that's a concern because switching on those beds is very, very slow. It's very difficult because to train an intensive care nurse, and that's what an intensive care bed is, in fact, is a bed that's staffed by a specialist intensive care nurse. It takes 6 months to a year to do that.
And how many staff do you need per bed?
The official, so we utilise a one-to-one nurse ratio. So every single ICU patient has a dedicated intensive care nurse. And that's international standards that we uphold to and we're very, very strongly adhere to. So on that basis, we need on average 5.6 nurses to open up one ICU bed. Mm-hmm. And so we'll say between 5 and 6 nurses. So it isn't an easy thing to do, and it's not a cheap thing to do. But it does take a long time to do it right because, as I said, it takes six months to a year to train a registered nurse to be an intensive care nurse so they can practice independently. And they are probably one of the most in-demand professions in the world, as you can imagine at the moment. Every country is looking for intensive care nurses. So our ability to take in overseas specialist intensive care nurses is not as good as it used to be for that very reason. So it's a huge challenge, certainly funding goes a long way towards it. So I haven't seen any details yet, only that there is a commitment to look at intensive care beds, which I think is very important. But the challenges within that need to be recognised.
Earlier in the chain, though, in the healthcare chain, if the pressure was taken off, it might lead to a reduction in pressure coming on later, so in the ICU ward.
Yeah, this is all down to the public health doctors who have done fantastic work so far. And if we can reduce the numbers coming to hospital, then we have a chance of running the intensive care service as normal without impacting on cancer care services, without impacting on cardiovascular services. So it is incredibly important that we get the public transmission rates down to a manageable rate so that services can continue in parallel. And so we're so aware of that.
We were talking a lot yesterday about parties that happened over the weekend, people congregating, whether it was in Oliver Bond Street flats in Dublin or in a field in Meath. I mean, you sit there on the sharp end of this. What do you think when you see that happening and when you hear people saying, you know, young people are fed up with this, they need to socialise, they need to get on with their lives?
I think a lot about this particular problem because I think we have to look at society in its totality, and within that there is a there's always going to be a non-conformist element to a normal society, if you like. So, and that is what is being demonstrated by these young people, very frustrated.
It's not all young people, we should say, as well.
Absolutely. I mean, just for the example that we saw at the weekend, certainly a lot of young people involved there, and I get that. And how we deliver the message to them, I think, needs to be slightly different how we deliver the message to other people in the population. So there needs to be different ways of delivering the message, because the message is just as important for those people as to everyone else. Yes, they're less likely to get sick themselves, but they're just as likely to pass it on to vulnerable people. And it's we have to accept that it is normal that this thing is likely to happen. And the way we deal with it is look for behavior scientists, to look for social scientists to say, what's the best way of delivering the message to those people? Because they will always be there. Mm-hmm. And as much as it frustrates me to see it, part of me understands it at the same time.
But if you have the non-conformists going about their business at the weekends or whenever they decide to have their parties, ultimately, would you say that's going to end up at your door?
Yes. That is the simple fact. Mm-hmm. The more this happens, the more likely transmission is in the community. I'm not agreeing with anything in any way, shape or form of what they're doing, but just understand that there's frustrations in some parts of society, and we have to, as a society, look at different ways, I think, of getting the message to those people to make sure that they can understand exactly what we're talking about. And maybe the mainstream media that we would listen to mostly may not be applicable to all populations. So that there's just that messaging system, I think, that needs to kind of be addressed as well. But it does, you're right. If the more people who are in close congregation with each other, the more likely virus will spread, the more likely someone who's vulnerable will get that and end up in the ICU in the Mater Hospital.
And where do you stand on restrictions where they currently are at the moment for Dublin, say, when we know why that had to happen, but we're seeing rising rates in other counties now. Would you rather see additional restrictions sooner rather than later, or do you think that we just have to let this play out now?
Look, again, I'm keen not to be giving public health advice in the same way as a public health doctor wouldn't be giving me intensive care advice. So I'm not best placed to do that, but I do see every time that the public health system kicks in to advise NPHET or to advise government on this, the rationale behind they do it, and I would support that. And I do think the restrictions of Dublin were needed. I do see the numbers rising again for the next few days, and hopefully we'll see a plateau and a reduction. If we don't, we're in a lot of bother when it comes to the hospital admissions and intensive care admissions. But yes, I think so far public health have done a fantastic job on this, and I would be keen to support them.
Yeah, and we've heard that message, you know, wherever you are in the country, reduce your contacts by half. I assume, given what you've said, you would support that.
Oh, absolutely. This is all about the virus. The virus doesn't have a brain. The virus doesn't have a central headquarter for strategy. The virus is purely a function of human behaviour. And if humans stay apart, the virus doesn't transmit. And that's been said from day one. And it's a simple message. And the only way it can transmit is being very close contact and not hand washing, etc. So those messages haven't changed. It's just how we get the message across to people, how we make it different each time, because fatigue seems to be setting in some sectors, in all sectors, I would say, but some sectors are probably more robust to applying the recommendations than others. Yes, the same message does apply. It is a function of human behaviour. Stay apart, wash your hands, and this virus will certainly reduce its transmission.
And even if you're having a lovely civilised dinner in your house, you're still at risk, right?
Yeah, again, it comes down to the proximity. You know, the least amount of people that we mix with, the less chance you have transmission. And this is just basic mathematics as well. You know, there's none of this is very, very complex. As I say, it isn't the message itself, it's how we get it out there. I think, the biggest challenge for public health doctors.
Well, Dr. O'Loughlin, yes.
Yes, that's the way it is at the moment.
Great. Dr. O'Loughlin, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. That's Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, who is President of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland. We're going to be talking about the Cabinet meeting, which is just underway this morning, finding out what might be under discussion there, and having a look at the level of cases around the country. Some areas are causing concern. More about that in just a moment.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.